John Sheridan from Monster Party joined me to discuss The Mummy and part 3 of our Universal Monster series. Prepare yourselves for legal analysis spanning nearly 4,000 years in the making. Hope you enjoy this episode.
Our next guest from Monster Party is the great illuminary, Sean Sheridan. Sean, how are you?
I'm great, Josh. Thanks so much for having me on this. This is awesome. I'm honored to be part of this.
Thank you so much. I so love listening to you and, you know, the others from Monster Party and hearing you guys debate. And this is fun to, you know, sit down and talk about one movie, just one-on-one, and sure. let each of you shine. For those who don't listen to Monster Party, can you tell us a little bit about your background?
Well, as far as myself, as part of the quartet of the Monster Party guys, I've just been a monster kid all my life. I work in reality TV and documentary type shows. I've been in that for several years. And I also write and I collect monster toys. And I'm a monster kid through and through who works in television to get money to buy cool monster stuff, basically. That's what I do. That's how we all, I got to know Matt and Larry James. We became Monster Party, and that's how I met you, too.
It's a beautiful thing. And, you know, it's like I used
the nerd practice. Synergy.
Yeah, I used the practice of law to buy my Godzilla and other toys.
Exactly, right.
And it's totally okay.
Right.
Well, let's talk about the 1932 classic, The Mummy. Mm-hmm. And when did you first see this movie?
The Mummy, like probably all of the classic Universal films, I first saw on television, late night television. I grew up on the East Coast in Pennsylvania, and I had horror hosts like Chili Billy, Uncle Ted, The Creep. These are probably be familiar with some people my age growing up on the East Coast. And all of the classic Universal monster films, of course, were shown on television on local TV stations when they did that kind of thing. And that's certainly where I first saw, you know, The Mummy, as well as the first Wolfman and Frankenstein. So I'm guessing, you know, when I was, you know, 9 or 10 years old is when I first was exposed to these films.
Awesome. You know, that kind of overlaps with like those of us who grew up in like the San Francisco Bay Area and watching creature features on channel.
Wilkins. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. The same, but different.
Yeah.
I guess you and James probably overlapped with some of the like programming being on the East Coast.
Yeah. I would hope that he's familiar with some of those same horror hosts. Like Chili Billy was probably the most famous. Chiller Theater went through a couple different incarnations. And the one that I think we all remember, James and myself and a lot of other people, was the stop motion, six-fingered chiller hand that came out of this little swamp and spelled the word chiller and then like descended back into the little puddle. That it was this, and it had this like really creepy voice, chiller. And that was just something, one of the first things I remember as a kid. And this was probably like midnight or 1 a.m. they would show, you know, horror films, and that hand was the way you got into the movies. That was definitely an iconic kind of like late night horror, you know, image.
Wow, that sounds oddly familiar. I will have to YouTube that.
Yeah, you can definitely find it on YouTube. Yeah, and there's even like a little model kit of the figure, which of course I have. And yeah, it's really cool.
It'd be weird not to.
Yes.
Well, jumping into The Mummy, why do you think this film is important in film history?
Well, it's definitely in the stable of the classic horror monster films from Universal. It followed Frankenstein and Dracula, and I think it's arguably one of Karloff's best horror roles, because the Frankenstein monster, he was brilliant, but in The Mummy, he gets to play kind of two roles in a way. He's very briefly the kind of shambling, you know, corpse-like mummy, but then he takes on his alter ego, you know, of Ardeth Bay. He's basically masquerading as this Egyptian. He's really the mummy. But that's where he gets to, you know, command the screen with his voice and his mysterious, you know, presence as he's, you know, trying to kind of, he's going after Zita Johann, who he sees as a reincarnation of Princess Anxinamen. So it's kind of like a little bit like Dracula. There are very similarities between, you know, Edgar Van Sloan playing this cat and mouse game with Bela Lugosi's Dracula, knowing what he is and how he has to stop him. Same thing in The Mummy. Edgar Van Sloan is like a similar role, and he kind of knows what Arthur Bey really is, and he has to kind of find a way to stop him, but knows that he's an extremely powerful, you know, dangerous being. So you have that. It's just you know, great acting scenes with Karloff and all these people, and I would say The Mummy is definitely a more stagey, talky film compared to a lot of the other classic Universal films, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's definitely less action oriented, but it just overflows with atmosphere and mood, and it's deliberately paced, you know. And you know, if you're in the mood for that kind of approach, then it's really fascinating movie.
And you know, there's a 1 year difference between Frankenstein to The Mummy, in which Karloff is both Universal monsters, and talk about two radically different creatures, because the way Karloff played Frankenstein was like a child, like you're
absolutely
like a 4-year-old, and you think of the horror on his face with what happens to little Maria, juxtaposed to the mummy's reaction to Helen, and I mean, just radically different, you know, from menacing to like kind of that lost child, confused. He had range. Being a monster is not easy. It's not just show up and growl. There's actually, he had a depth to two very different creatures.
Right. Yeah. The mummy is very much a love story, a tragic kind of romance where, you know, in the very beginning, in the Egyptian times, Karloff was in love with Anxinamen, and he wanted to bring her back to life after she died. And so he used the sacred scroll of Thoth to try to bring her back, and that was forbidden, and that's why he was buried alive, for, you know, desecrating this ritual, this, you know, doing this. And so it's over time, over thousands of years, you know, he's still trying to find her. He finds her in I think it's Helen's, you know, he thinks it's, you know, the reincarnation of Anxinamen. So, but yes, he's menacing, and he's very, he's thinking very carefully of his plan. He's intelligent. He's smart. He's not like the 10-day-year-old child creation that Frankenstein was. He's a villain. He's a true villain, but still with, a tragic kind of love, you know, lost love aspect to it, which I think is, you know, yes, he's doing evil, horrible things, but to him, it's like, it's destiny. You know, he's doing all these things to get to his love.
Indeed it is, which also brings me to one of the things that I was really impressed with about the film. And that's the practical effects at the beginning with the mummy.
Absolutely.
You know, like, you work in, you know, television. What are your thoughts on, you know, the, I believe it was Jack Pierce who did, you know, that makeup, which arguably would be as good, if not better, than some of the stuff we've seen today.
Yeah, it's amazing. The you have kind of the two different types of makeup, because the full on, you know, mummy makeup where they literally, you know, they bandaged Karloff up head to toe in bandages. And I believe what I have read is that it was Jack Pierce's makeup for Karloff and the mummy was maybe the longest and most arduous to do, and the hardest on Karloff. It was, you know, this was before latex appliances, you know, and it was cotton and spirit gum and just layers and layers and drying it with a blow dryer. And it was like hours and hours. And it was, I believe, even tougher to take it off. And what's amazing too is that the dedication and the detail that they put into that full-on mummy makeup, because you only see him in that makeup for literally maybe a couple minutes, you know, if that total running time. You see him, you know, in the coffin, and then when he comes to life and, you know, scares that one guy and who goes crazy when he sees him. You don't even see Karloff walking. You see his hand, you see his bandages trailing off when he leaves the doorway, but they still made him up completely, you know, completely in the, in that makeup. And it's amazing. It does look, you know, whether or not it looks exactly like a real mummy is, you know, beside the point. It just looks amazing. And then the, even in some ways more elegant makeup as, with Karloff as Ardeth Bey, because it's kind of still kind of wrinkled and aged, but not to like a hideous level, you know, but still kind of withered and something unearthly and strange about it. And, you know, he's got the fez hat, and they added the lights in his eyes and glow, and just really, really cool. But yeah, it's, I mean, I think that makeup holds up totally today. Like, there's nothing phony or dated about the look of Karloff. I think it absolutely holds up still.
Glad you agree. It's watching that scene, because I don't think I'd seen The Mummy up until this point in time. You know, after listening to your guys' podcast on Creature from the Black Lagoon that, you know, I had the idea to do this. Right. And I probably had seen parts of it in childhood, but this was like the first time to sit down and like really watch it. You know, it was just kind of like one of those things that's just assumed in the collective consciousness of society that you've seen this movie. And the way Imhotep comes back to life with the eyes slowly opening.
Very slowly, yeah.
And, you know, the debris kind of like breaking free as the arms start moving again, you know, because bodies aren't supposed to come back to life. And the way that they shot it, it's detailed. I mean, you can, and especially on Blu-ray, you can see a lot coming off of him as he staggers away. It's just like, it is beautifully shot.
Yeah.
And anybody would scream their guts out seeing that.
Especially back then in 1932, imagine the audiences, yeah.
Yeah, I do admit I was a tad disappointed because I was expecting a little more like mumminess, like walking around. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I see how that influenced the Brendan Fraser film, you know, from what was, I think, 99, of Imhotep coming back and like getting reconstituted. For me, that raised his interesting questions of like, what did he do for a decade? You know, like, how did he?
That's true.
And so, you know, if you're a, you know, come back to life after 3,700 years, the world's very different. It's like, how did he figure out, I'm going to go get some clothes? And
it's a good question. I also wonder, like, because basically is he impersonating somebody? Like, was there an Ardeth Bey Egyptian that he killed and took his place? You know, or did he just simply create that name? Like, I'm not sure, because like, he's basically masquerading as this person that he isn't, you know, so where did that come from? You know, like, how long did it take for him to kind of slightly rejuvenate so he didn't look like the way he did in the beginning of the movie? And yeah, like, maybe it took that long simply to kind of like figure out his master plan and what to do, you know, but that's a good question.
Yeah, it's like, how long have I been dead?
Right.
You know, why, you know, how do I like rehydrate? Because
does he eat and drink? Does he have to? You know,
it's like, does he live someplace, or is he just literally just hanging out in the desert?
Because he just shows up in that first scene, knocks on the door. Hey, hi, by the way, I know where the tomb is. Follow me.
and since it's 1932, it's like, sure, let's go. Yeah. And it's like, no questions asked, Mr. Creepy Dude, who looks super aged.
He looks a lot like Boris Karloff, yeah.
Nothing bad will come of this. Everything's going to be fine.
Right.
Yeah, there's a few things there to unpack that left me wondering, you know, like, how's this going to play out? But on that level, him interacting in modern society was well done. And
yeah.
And creepy.
I like him at the museum, you know, he's doing his ritual and the guy comes in and finds him and he kills him. Yeah, I mean, it's just, he's just lurking around, you know, just kind of like trying to do his thing. And everybody knows he's a little weird and like, who is this guy, you know?
Well, that, and he's, in your opinion, how is he really different than the other monsters that we've seen, whether it's, say, Dracula, Frankenstein, Creature from the Black Lagoon, or Wolfman? Because, like, some of those are victims.
Right, right.
He's not.
No, he's loquacious to a point. I mean, he can kind of, I guess the difference is that, you know, unlike the Wolfman or Frankenstein, he can kind of semi pass off as a regular person in normal society. I mean, I suppose Dracula could do that too, Count Dracula, you know, because he was a distinguished count. Ardeth Bey is kind of a, you know, he's this maybe so-called distinguished, you know, mysterious Egyptian who kind of knows a lot about the history of Egypt and a lot about this stuff. So in that way, yeah, he's not a feral animal like the Wolfman. He's not a kind of like misshapen concoction of parts like the Frankenstein monster. So, and he's not like an animal like the creature, you know, so he can kind of pass off in regular society, and he's smart and he can plan things, you know, to do things. So, and he kind of seems to have a mystical power too over people. I mean, he can, you know, he actually has some amazing powers because he can literally kind of influence the pain and death of people from across great expanses of locations. Just by concentrating, but looking at this kind of cool pool, you know, he causes the one professor's death. He almost kills David Manners' character, you know. So he has this kind of like almost all-seeing supernatural ability, you know. So that's definitely a formidable, you know, quality.
Well, that, and, you know, he has an intent, which I think is different, because Frankenstein you feel sorry for, because, you know, he's created and he's stumbling around trying to fit in, and, you know, that's a child that needs to be loved and raised, not hunted with torches.
Right.
Creature, he just wants to hang out in his lagoon.
Yeah, just keep the poor guy alone. Yeah, exactly.
Imhotep has, I want the love of my life back, and I don't care who I kill to get her. Like, that's...
This is one sole purpose.
And so there's a, you know, a malice about him that the others don't have. Maybe a little bit of the Wolfman, but again, that's just a feral animal, comparatively speaking.
Right.
And so I don't really feel any pity for him, whereas I did for other Universal monsters because of his, you know, intent to do harm to others, which is just different.
Yeah. Even Dracula has a little bit of the pathos because, you know, he's immortal and, you know, he kind of always has to find a new love and, like, you know, he didn't know what to, you know, to be dead, to be really dead, that must be glorious. That's a famous line he says, you know, like, he can't die, really. It's, you know, whereas Imhotep, I think, is just kind of doesn't worry too much about that. He just wants what he wants. You know, he's not, don't think he has really too much angst, really. He just has drive, you know?
Very different. And I mean, it is fascinating to look at him and go, wow, Karloff also played the monster. And which just makes me appreciate him more.
Totally.
So one of the neat things about all these monster movies is, you know, the toys that are made.
Oh, yeah.
How many mummy toys do you have?
Well, I love the I think it was like in the late 90s, early 2000s, Sideshow put out these great kind of 8-inch figures of all the classic monsters. And so I have the 8-inch figure of that mummy, of Karloff as the mummy. He's got the little, you know, scroll he's holding. He's got the little Egyptian runes on the base. And it's fantastic. Great likeness. It's like some of the best stuff that Sideshow put out. I also have, when I was a kid, I had this in the 70s, you know, the toy company Mego put out lots of, you know, superhero figures, Planet of the Apes figures. They made this series called the Mad Monster figures, and they were not visually based on the Universal Monsters. Maybe they didn't have the rights, but they were still cool, kind of more mod, kind of like versions of the monsters. And the Mummy is really cool. It's very different. It doesn't look like the Universal Monster, but it's still very cool. It has glow-in-the-dark eyes and hands and this kind of cool exposed face, and just it's very different. But I love that figure. So those I think are probably the two main Mummy figures I have. Oh, and I think a little 3-inch figure I have too that I put out in the '80s, 3 or 4 inch.
Nice. Yeah, there's no shortage of swag. You know, I live not too far from Time Tunnel Toys.
Oh, great! Love that place.
Yeah, it is. Visit at least once a month, you know, getting action figures for blog posts. And yeah. I was looking at some of their Mummy figures that they have in addition to, you know, some of the other classic monsters. And yeah, there are some amazingly detailed figures out there. Well, we've danced around some of these issues, but do you have any legal questions after watching this again while we were getting ready for this podcast?
Yeah. As you, since I knew I was going to be doing this podcast with you, I thought about that when I watched the film again recently. I mean, the main thing that came to mind right away was when the characters actually open up the tomb. That is, you know, that's desecrating sacred Egyptian, a sacred Egyptian site, you know. And I know that this movie came out, you know, probably about 10 years earlier was the Tutankhamun, the discovery of the Tutankhamun tomb, and how there was a lot of stuff in the press about the curse of that, a real curse, and people seem to die. So many people involved in the unearthing of that tomb seem to die under strange circumstances. And of course, they play that up in the new movie too, the curse. But just the idea of that, you know, archaeologists in the name of science, you know, are desecrating sacred, you know, sacred areas that, you know, burial chambers that were, you know, religiously are so important and sacred to the Egyptian way of life. And so, you know, I guess that comes up, is that what kind of protection would there be to not allow that kind of thing to happen, to have, you know, just Americans come in and just left and right, you know, digging up and desecrating all these sacred tombs.
Yeah. There's law in the books now because of that. Because when you look at, you know, things from the early 20s of these, you know, archaeological expeditions, mm-hmm. on one side you do have science, and we want to know what happened 3,000 years ago. Right. And, like, that's one of the ways that we can learn is from these tombs or time capsules. And, you know, can they be investigated in a way that does not violate cultural history, cultural rights, right. Desecrate religious importance to those cultures. You know, there's a lot there. And then the other half is we don't want, like, cultural appropriation taking place where it's European powers and America, you know, going and, you know, like, pilfering.
Yeah, imperialism, yeah.
Right. Yeah, it's like, because we don't want that happening either. You know, like, right. This... At least in this film, there was, you know, a reference to, you know, the finds weren't leaving Egypt, that they were going to the museum. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that there's a quote in there about this is about science, not loot.
Right.
So like, okay, good. Like, you know, you know, and that's one of those things that society has to balance of, we want to understand the past and what happened long ago, but not have it be pilfered.
Right.
Desecrated, and, you know, like, those are value judgments.
Is there a time limit? Like, is there, like, what point do you say, okay, now it's okay to dig this stuff up, you know?
I think it's going to depend on the country, and, like, those are legislative decisions that, right. You know, have to be made of, do we want to understand the past and what happened versus, you know, Napoleon rolling through Egypt and doing target practice at the Sphinx. Like, you know, it's like, that's right. Like... you know, like, just an abomination of history that that happened. It's like, so it's one thing to have a scientific expedition that's done with, you know, the country where it's located, and, you know, conforms in a way that respects all, cultural heritage and isn't like pilfering. Cause like, we don't want that. There's law on the books and treaties that have come down, mostly post-World War II, about cultural history and cultural rights. And some of this, I read a detailed law review article that took place after the Arab Spring, where, you know, the Egyptian Revolution took place, because their, you know, museums were broken into, and there were things that were stolen. There were mummies that were beheaded. And, and like, it's like, ew, no. And people who were really, you know, Egyptians who were like really frustrated and freaked out that that was happening, and and citizens who've like formed human barriers to protect museums, and because like they didn't, it's like no, like this is history. We don't want you burning it. And so I'm like, that it's a tough one, you know, to balance, because like we don't want like grave robbing taking place.
Right, yeah, because some people can look at it just as that. It's just simple grave robbing.
Yeah, and we do have laws on the books in the United States that, like, we don't want human remains removed from, like, Indian, you know, Native American burial grounds. Mm-hmm. And there are cases that deal with, even though, like, this is, like, you know, like, bone fragments that could be considered almost, like, fossil level, it was still removal from a grave and like not okay. Right. So there's that societal balancing that has to take place of when do we want to look at this versus when do we feel like this is radically inappropriate and we're grave robbing, we're doing, you know, cultural damage. Right. And I know, I don't know the right answer to that. I mean, it's a value judgment societies have to make of, you know, it's like we want to understand our past. You know, like if Imhotep had come back to life, and instead of like trying to stalk a dead woman and go after her reincarnated spirit, let's say if he became a professor instead.
Right.
And you know, first off, that would have a radical impact on religion, because like, so you came back from the dead? You're, what are you? Because like, you know, there are issues in the film, like he doesn't want to touch anyone. And I don't know I don't know if that's because he's cold to the touch.
Yeah, I don't know.
Is he still a corpse and like not, you know, are we dealing with reanimated zombie type, or is he?
Yeah, I mean,
because he refuses to shake hands and says, "Oh, it's our prejudice." Right. It's like, I think you're just covering up the fact you don't want to shake hands because you're a 3,000-year-old dead body. But like, if he had become a professor to talk about this is what life was like when I was alive, and that would be a different way to look at it, but that's not what he does.
Right. Well, my other question too legally is, if let's say, you know, at the end of the film, Imhotep doesn't actually die. I mean, they basically take him in. You know, they capture him and arrest him. So, what kind of laws would he fall under, though, if he's over 3,000-year-old mummy? So, does he even fall under any kind of modern jurisdiction at all?
The answer is, he should. You could go with the current laws of Egypt. You tried murdering a woman in order to mummify her, in order to then resurrect her, to cleanse her original soul of the other lives she had lived over the last 3,700 years. That's still attempted murder. So you could charge him with that. Now, he could raise some defense that he's a sovereign citizen, you know, and like my existence predates, you know, this nation. Therefore, you know, like I'm not subject to its laws. But normally you would have, you know, I don't know if he would claim that his crypt is, you know, where he's from, therefore he's a sovereign citizen of that. Mm-hmm. You can make that argument. It'd be super weird. But on the flip, I'm like, you could make it. I don't know if it would work because we don't have, you know, people who are 30, you know, 700 years old walking around who predate a nation.
Right, right.
But that would be his argument. I would still think, okay, we'll apply the laws of ancient Egypt, which still say that you committed sacrilege in trying to resurrect this woman. Therefore, you're still on the hook for that.
Right, right.
Therefore, we're going to, you know, encase you back in your tomb, right, and you can just stay there. Ha ha.
Right.
Because we don't know if he needs to eat or anything.
Right, right. And I think, I mean, as far as all the killings that do take place in the movie, I mean, the first guy kind of just goes crazy when he sees him. There is the one kind of guard or assistant, whatever, in the museum that we see kind of off screen he kills physically. But there's also the guy, then the professor, who he simply kind of seems to cause to have a heart attack from afar. So how would you prove that as evidence? You know, maybe the other ones, the other murders how do you prove that?
Yeah, showing that, you know, Sir Joseph Wemple was murdered by magic.
Yeah, right.
By a mummy that was 3,700 years old would be a challenge for a prosecutor, because how do you show the mystical elements that were done?
Right,
and
right.
It's like, here's my pool with the smoke that fills up. And let's be honest, that is a cool effect that still holds up well.
Yeah.
Well done, special effects guy in 1931. Well done. It'd be a challenge for a prosecutor to show murdered by magic. It could be done. I don't know how, but you would need a jury that's really open-minded to believe in that.
Yeah.
And from a religion.
But also I'd say that Helen, Zita Johann's character, in the movie, she kind of goes back and forth with, like, struggling with her current day self, and also realizing, oh, I am Unc Sunamun. So if Ardeth Bay was put in trial to say he was trying to kill, you know, Helen, but if Helen was examined and you know, well enough, maybe they would be, yeah, but you admitted that you're the reincarnation of Unc Sunamun, and what Ardeth Bay was trying to do is simply to kind of bring your spirit into this body or whatever. So, you know, it's kind of like she was under his spell, but like she also seemed to claim. I mean, I guess the question is like, is there a way to prove that she really is or was the incarnation of Unc Sunamun? If so, you know, does that give any merit to what Ardeth Bay was trying to do?
I'd still say murder's murder, you know, and because she does admit that, you know, I am this princess, but I'm also somebody else. And, you know, a psychologist would have a field day with that of reincarnation and memories from past life, lives coming into play on, you know, how that would impact somebody psychologically. Because, you know, is there a fusion? Is there a, you know, are the past lives repressed in a way so they don't, you know, derail, you know, the current life?
Right.
But, you know, the fact of the matter is we have a warm, living body with a heartbeat, and he was going to kill her by stabbing her in the stomach, which let's think about, that wouldn't be instant death and would be a painful way to go.
Right.
It wasn't the heart, that was her belly. And, you know, it's like, that's not a kill shot.
I think he says in the movie, like, there'll be a moment of agony and then, you know, then pure heaven and pure, well, it's still agony though at that moment.
Murder be murder.
Yeah, exactly.
you're going to kill the pretty lady. Still not okay. She definitely has some mental capacity issues because she's all over the map. Watching her in the film, it's strange because it's dated, and you can see that she's kind of treated as the object, but she's also the one who saves the day. And it's an odd portrayal. You know, when you look at, say, you compare her to other, you know, heroines, you know, she's not a, you know, Kay from Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Right.
And nor is she a Gwen from Wolfman.
Right, yeah. Yeah, she's, and it's interesting, I think a lot of that came out from the actual actress, because Zita Johann was this very prominent Hungarian stage actress who actually believed in reincarnation and all kinds of mysticism and spirituality. She believed in all this stuff. She was kind of out there herself in real life, and apparently had a lot of had a lot of headbutting and locking horns a lot with Carl Froning, the director at the time. So she was very much kind of a diva, but just also really into it. Like, she would, you know, call the spirit of whoever and to play her part. She was out there. So I think that kind of reflects in her performance in the movie.
Yeah, I could, watching the film, I do have like some directorial questions of like, that was the best one? Like, that's, but and if they were like, you know, butting heads, that makes a lot more sense.
Possibly.
Just because they're, yeah, it doesn't seem wooden, it just seems out there.
It's theatrical, very theatrical, like as if she's on a stage. Yeah, it's in some ways her performance is a little less naturalistic than the rest of the performances, you know, most of the performances. And it is still, being 1932, it's still a little bit on the theatrical side, sure.
Well, that the way that, was it Frank, you know, hits on her while she's recovering, that's just a little creepy.
Yeah, that's a little weird. Yeah.
It's like she just had some weird psychotic episode where she went to the museum and was banging on the door, "Let me in," and doesn't remember it.
Right.
And now you're flirting with her.
Totally.
Have you no decency, sir? That's just wrong. So, I mean,
too, like, I wonder, like, about just the religious aspects. You know, the beliefs of Arif Bey. You know, I mean, he believes what he does, and it's fine to do what he's doing because of his beliefs. So that comes into question too, I guess. You know, like, as far as under the law, like, you know, well, yeah, I think it's you know, it's okay. My religion says I can do this, or my beliefs say I can do this. You know, so screw your laws. You know, this is what I do. This is from my background, from my history. You know.
Yeah, that historically doesn't work out well for people to take the. It's my right to have multiple wives, and it's
right.
Sorry, no, we don't do that here. And yeah, it's. Yeah, that didn't work out for, say, the state of Utah when they came into the country. So no, we don't do that. So the religious argument of it's my right to murder other people doesn't fly.
Right.
And yeah, plenty of court cases. I mean, plenty of cults have been prosecuted for people who have, you know, declared themselves the prophet.
Right.
The problem with him is he actually did come back from the dead.
Right.
So that would be a game changer, because there would be people who line up, and then you would have a very weird reaction from, you know, those who want to follow, you know, this ancient faith versus, yeah, that was the one that enslaved all those, you know, Israelites, you know, and, you know, to build pyramids. And remember how that ended. You know, there was a reason why that, you know, the Ten Commandments say what they say. And, you know, yeah, this movie has some really uncomfortable religious overtones that pick up very quickly. And because there is divine intervention a couple times, and it's, you know, not, you know, Judeo-Christian divine intervention. So
Right.
And like, that's never resolved because
it's true.
It is creepy. It's uncomfortable, because that's what happens when you have a nearly 4,000-year-old dead guy running the streets. So
would the scroll itself, the scroll of Thoth, be evidence then too? Because that's the, you know.
Yeah, I would think so. Even though they had to destroy it in order to defeat him, but if he was prosecuted, I could see, you know, the ancient Egyptian society that had the ability to resurrect people, they weren't doing it. You know, like, they viewed and, you know, they prosecuted, you know, Imhotep for trying to raise the princess from the dead, because, you know, they viewed this as a societal, you know, sacrilege, that we just don't do this. We don't go around resurrecting people, even if it's somebody that we love.
Right.
So for them, that was a taboo. And that's an interesting one. because they didn't practice it. And there had to be a reason that if you have the power to resurrect people and you're not.
Right, right. It was written up. It was all figured out how to do it, but it was to do it. Maybe it was attempted before and, you know, resulted in disastrous, you know, situation.
Well, even Imhotep, you know, tells Helen, you know, that I could bring, you know, her first body back to life, but it would be the soulless puppet that he would command.
Right, right. That's right.
Mm-hmm. And maybe that had been the issue of like, oh, wow, we now have soulless corpses walking around. Mm-hmm. Not what we want.
Right, right.
That would disturb the population's sense of Zen if
right.
Grandma suddenly came back as a lifeless, you know, soulless corpse that's just right. wandering the streets. That would tend to freak people out. And I could see why legislation would be passed to say we're not going to do this.
Mm-hmm.
But it would be an interesting court hearing to go like, oh yeah, watch this. And, you know, they have, you know, a professor bring a body back to life, you know, as, you know, as a experiment. It's like, whoa, time out. That would have a impact on society that would make people uncomfortable.
Very much.
So, well, this has been a lot of fun to discuss.
Awesome.
And, you know, it's neat to actually hang out with you because
totally.
You know, listening to Monster Party when you guys come out, you know, it feels like I'm hang out frequently.
Oh, yeah. Well, we'd love to have you on as a guest.
I'd love to visit. And
we got to get you on again.
Yeah, it's, you know, maybe for the mythical Star Wars one that
yeah, we keep hinting at, yes.
It's the 40th anniversary isn't over yet, so.
All right.
But it's so much fun to actually talk with you guys.
Totally.
You know, individually on things that you love so much. And I appreciate your time and, you know, give my best to Gina. And
absolutely. Well, I love this angle that you guys take too with this. I mean, it's really cool because, you know, we love this stuff and we're so familiar with all these films and we love all these monster characters, but the unique Legal Geeks angle to it is really cool and fun. You know, it's great.
Thank you so much. So
You're
with
welcome,
that, have a wonderful day, and up next, Frankenstein.
All right. See ya.
Thank you.